Good afternoon, everyone. Beautiful day today on January 21, 2026. This is the House Finance Committee. I'm Andy Josephson, the chair of the Operating Budget. I'll call this meeting to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:32 on the 21st of January, Wednesday. Present today are Representative Moore. Representative Moore, welcome to our committee. Representative Bynum, Representative Allard, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Stapp. Representative Jimmy is absent today. Representative Galvin, Representative Hannon, Co-Chair Schrage, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, as I noted, Co-Chair Josephson. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff. Normally, we have them introduce themselves, but we're in year two. We have Committee Assistant Helen Phillips. I think of her as one of my many bosses, along with Jessica Geary and my constituents and others. We have a new page, Tallulah Lastufka, Secretary Bree Wiley, and Secretary Leah Frazier. And Representative Tomaszewski is here. We also have our moderator, Emily Mesh, from the Legislative Information Office. Looks like she's training someone. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. Also, committee members, our presenters, and the public should be aware that our committee business today has a hard stop at 2:55. In today's meeting, we will hear the Department of Natural Resources present the fall 2025 oil production forecast. With us today from the department is Derek Nottingham, Director for the Division of Oil and Gas, and Travis Peltier, Petroleum Reservoir Engineer for the Division of Oil and Gas. Representative Allard is not here for the record, so I'll clarify that record. Director Nottingham and Mr. Peltier, please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman Josephson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Derek Nottingham. I'm the director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and on behalf of Commissioner Designee John Crowther, I want to just say thank you for the opportunity to present the production forecast today. He could not be with us. He got called away to a cabinet meeting. He does look forward to the coming session and engaging with the committee over various oil and gas issues. I would like to say, just kind of starting out, just to give a little bit of a high-level overview of the production forecast, and then I'll let my comrade here, Travis, kind of get into the meat of it. But this is a really exciting year because this is kind of the year we've been waiting for. We're going to see new production come online from Pikka, and Travis will talk about that a little bit more. We've seen lots of progress over the last year in the Pikka project with construction activities, facilities being installed, lots of wells being drilled, and so that is a very exciting thing. We've seen lots of activity on the Willow project as well, so lots of progress on the big North Slope projects. You'll also see some information on just ongoing activities like what we've witnessed happening at a field like Milne Point. So very, very interesting story that Travis will elaborate on, but lots of really good positive things going on in the production forecast. And you'll see as we look forward into the next 10 years, we're seeing the production increase from where we are today upward of 600,000 barrels by the end of the 10-year forecast. So with that, I'll turn it over to Travis and let him walk us through the presentation.
Thank you, Director. We've been joined by Representative Allard at 1:36. Mr. Peltier.
All right, thank you. For the record, my name is Travis Peltier. I'm a petroleum reservoir engineer in the resource evaluation section of the Division of Oil and Gas within the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. Just for some background, I graduated from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in 2006 with a Master's of Science in Mechanical Engineering and have spent the past 19 years working in Alaska's oil industry, predominantly on the North Slope as a petroleum engineer for BP. In my 14 years with that company, I worked all the fields they owned, from the Kuparuk River unit all the way west to the Point Thompson unit in the east. In 2021, I was lucky, and I joined the Department of Natural Resources in my current position as the Petroleum Reservoir Engineer. And in 2022, I was asked to lead the development of the state of Alaska's oil production forecast. And I'm honored to continue leading that effort and the team that develops the forecast biannually for the state. So just to set context for today, we'll be talking about the Alaska's oil production forecast for the next decade. And for your awareness, the Department of Natural Resources has been performing this analysis since 2016. The goal for today is to share the production forecast results not just for fiscal year 2025, but also the forecast for the next 10 years, including methodology and background on how the forecast is generated.
And Mr. Pelter, we've been joined by Representative Underwood. We like to recognize our colleagues when they're here. Please continue.
Before we get into the meat of the presentation, I'm going to just briefly show, and that way everyone has this for reference, a list of acronyms that might be used during this presentation. The one I'm only going to focus on for now, since it's used repeatedly throughout this, is for, on the left column, the fourth one down, BOPD, whether capitalized or not capitalized, stands for barrels of oil per day. The rest of the presentation, if we use acronyms on a slide, I have them in the bottom of that page so they can be easily referenced. But this is just a reference for folks who want to come back to this. Okay. Today, again, we're going to talk about the forecast preview. We'll just show everyone what the forecast looks like. We'll talk about fiscal year 2025 in review. We'll go through then the DNR fall 2025 production forecasting approach and how we generated the next 10-year forecast. And then we'll get into the results in summary. And if there are other questions, we do have some material in appendix. We don't plan to go through that unless questions arise.
Okay. Please continue. Slide four.
Thank you. So the fall 2025 North Slope annualized forecast is on this chart. And just to put everyone on reference for how the charts look, they're all going to be fairly repetitive on the left-hand axis. For this one, we have the fiscal year annualized average daily oil production. So, for instance, you know, fiscal year 2026, our internal forecast is around 465,000 barrels of oil per day. And you can see that on the left-hand side of the chart, the y-axis goes from 0 to 1 million barrels per day, and the data points are single years for fiscal year along the x-axis. What we have here is from the Department of Revenue's Revenue Sources book, the chart that represents low official forecast and high can also be found in the Revenue Sources book, Table 6-8. We overlay on there because we receive this information confidentially, but we roll it up for this production forecast, the operators of currently producing fields to compare our forecast against theirs. And so that's what you see in the dashed line overlying these charts as well. You can see there is a discrepancy for fiscal year 2026. The operator forecast is higher. Starting in fiscal year 2027, it's lower. And again, I just want to reiterate, the operator's forecast is for currently operating fields. So this does not include in the operator forecast. Future fields like Pikka are not included, whereas in our forecast, it is.
Okay. Okay. Let's go to slide six.
So we're going to take a look at how did we do last year, what happened with actual field production. So the next few slides will not actually have forecast information. This is a review. So the fiscal year 2025, how did we actually do? Just to kind of reiterate, I'll talk to the chart on the right in a minute, but every year when we put these this together for the forecast, we're looking to have basically an uncertainty within the next fiscal year of about plus or minus 5%. That's kind of what we're looking for, our range of acceptability on the forecast. For this past year, actual fiscal year 2025 production ended up being 0.3% greater than the forecast that we presented to you last year. I'll talk about that chart here on the right to kind of elaborate that, just transitioning. You know, same axis, it only goes from 0 to 600,000 barrels a day. What we have here are a number of items in the bar chart. On the far left, the high side of the forecast, the DNR high, was, I'm going to round here, about 510,000 barrels of oil per day. The low range that we had in the forecast was 424,000 barrels of oil per day. The actual forecast was, the mean forecast we had presented to this committee last year was just over 466,000 barrels of oil per day, and the actual ended up being just under 468,000 barrels of oil per day. So overall, we're within that plus or minus 5% range, which we are targeting.
Mr. Peltier, question from Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Peltier, your forecasting seemed to be on point, but it looks like the operators were over-optimistic. Do you do follow-up questions back to them of where that 20,000 barrels they thought were going to produce didn't produce, or is that because it's aggregated data, we don't know who, you know, maybe 20 companies each predicted a 1,000, or is there a specific hole that didn't get drilled?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, since we have the data at the field level, we've interrogated that internally, but we have not gone back to ask operators specifically why they were over or under their specific forecasts. Again, we use the operator forecast as a comparator, but we don't rely on their forecasts to generate our own. We do them wholly independently.
Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
Okay. And I was going to mention this, so thanks, operator, or Representative Hannon, for bringing it up. The operator line on the far right of this chart, the last year, the summation for all of the operator responses was just under 487,000 barrels of oil per day as our comparator for last year. Now, there are a couple things that we look at when we're shaping this forecast every year. When we ask operators for feedback about how things are going, you know, there's a lot of times we get similar responses from the various operators who work both the North Slope and Cook Inlet fields. One of the things that we continue to hear is that industry interest, and we've seen this in lease sales as well, continues in the Brookian topset prospects, both on state and federal land. You might have heard in the news Sockeye 2A's exploration results just to the west of Point Thompson, to the east of the Badami fields that came out this past winter season. And that just kind of exemplifies why various companies are interested in these plays. Other exploration activities and opportunities on federal leases have also increased with the current administration. We're seeing 4 wells up for exploration just in the NPRA this year alone. Moderate oil prices and capital discipline across the industry are headwinds for development. We do see that as well with our various operators and the responses they provide to us. Oil price does affect their operation. And then inflation, relatively high interest rates, and insurance challenges are affecting North Slope exploration projects, costs, and operations.
Representative Galvin Van Stapp.
Thank you. My question is regarding the last bullet around inflation. I know that in the last year we experienced a couple of reductions in inflation. We went from 5% in January of 25 to 3.7 in December, for example. I just wondered if you have a sense from hearing from the operators, what would their ideal interest rate be? I'm a little puzzled by that being a deep challenge of theirs.
Mr. Peltier.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. Thanks for the question. So when we talk about inflation, oil field inflation is generally distinct from kind of CPI inflation numbers.
So this is just general inflationary costs, through the chair? Is that what we're referring to?
This would be, I'd call it oil field inflation. It's usually not an order of magnitude higher, but a lot of times, I'm not going to say what the operators told us, but you know, if you see back in the, I think, kind of 2010 to 2014 timeframe, you know, the consumer price index might go up at 2% per year, but oil field inflation during that time was 10%. So year on year, when you're seeing prices increase like that, it does get hard to continue to develop. And that's what we're seeing here is just oil field inflation has been running hotter than the CPI inflation number.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, quick follow-up. So that would include things such as labor and subcontractors and all of those pieces that they're just prices are going up. Okay,
through the chair, Representative Galvin, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin. Through the chair to Mr. Peltier. Always a pleasure. Thanks for being here. It's great to be back and great first meeting, Mr. Co-Chair. Nothing like the oil production forecast to get us started on the year, I think. Regarding point 3 and 4 on first oil price and capital discipline, we've seen a kind of a remarkable investment in capital and not only in existing infrastructure but exploration wells and this year and last year from our wonderful partners in industry. Do we know how we compare to other areas of the country, given this kind of inflationary pressure and falling prices? Because it would appear to me like Alaska is still kind of a place that people are looking at these plays that you mentioned, Sockeye 2. And it seems like industry is going to relatively high risk to continue to invest in our states. That's my first question through the chair.
Mr. Peltier.
You want to take it?
Or director.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Stapp. So the comparison of inflation from the lower 48 to up here, I can't unfortunately speak to. I think what I can illustrate and share, again, this would be qualitative, right, not quantitative, is that costs to operate in Alaska are generally significantly higher than they are in the lower 48. You can talk to various folks who work down there versus folks who work up here, but, and again, this is qualitative, not quantitative, but it might cost, you know, low millions of dollars to drill wells up down in the lower 48, and to drill similar wells up here might be multiples of that.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Kutcher.
Yes, follow up.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Kutcher. Through the chair, Mr. Peltier. So this one's going to be relatively simple. Given the fact that we have a lot of capital investment from industry in the slope, and we are having new production, even in the face of moderate price declines in, again, companies performing capital discipline and even layoffs in some case, what would be the worst course of action that we could take as a legislature to disincentivize that? Through the chair.
That may be for the director.
Yes.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I don't know that I can speak to what the worst course of action the legislature could take, but I will say that maintaining a very competitive environment for Alaska business, whether prices are low or whether they're high, is probably, you know, the best course of action for the state. I mean, you know, we are in a competitive industry. There are other places for companies to invest their capital dollars. And, you know, so whatever edges the state of Alaska can maintain for its competitive advantage, I would hope that the legislature consider that strongly.
Thank you.
Mr. Peltier, the Sockeye 2A, the Brookian topset, you said it's west of Point Thompson. I've had the pleasure of visiting Point Thompson. And is it the Canning River is also west of Point Thompson? There's disputed land there that's still being litigated. And I'm just curious whether the interest you've described in the bullet is in that river delta in disputed area, or is it undisputed area?
Yeah, Chair Josephson, I believe the Canning River is actually on the east side of Point Thompson. The border between the NPRA and the state lands is okay. The contested area. And the Sockeye 2A is definitely west of Point Thompson, so nowhere near the disputed lands area for that specific river.
Great. Yes, Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. I think I misspoke earlier when I was talking about rates. I really meant interest rates. So interest rates are dropping. I would guess that would be helpful, but it still says, though, that we are – that they are – the operators are suggesting that high interest rates are still a problem. And that's what I really wanted to get at, was the interest rates, not so much as inflation. Do you have a comment on that? Like what is an ideal rate then, if there would be an ideal rate?
Mr. Peltier or the director?
I can give it a go if you want. Yeah. All right. For the record, this is Travis Peltier. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, thanks again for clarifying the question. For the interest rates, I believe this is more of a threshold for private loans and financing. So, again, if you're referencing interest rates that are put forth by the Federal Reserve, yeah. I know those are public. Private industry typically has to pay a significantly higher interest rate to get loans for new developments. I don't know what those numbers are. We could get back to you with some information about that, but I suspect that's going to be difficult because those are usually held very confidential.
I see. Through the chair,
follow up.
I may.
Mm-hmm.
So you're referring to interest rates that are not the federal interest rates. It's whatever is on top of that that's through private lenders. Is that what I'm hearing? Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, yes.
There's no need to get back on that. I think I can figure that out. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Let's go to slide 7 if we're ready.
Yes. So this is a chart showing similar information as what we had on the previous one. We We, the Department of Natural Resources, introduced it last year. This simply shows the 12-month forecast broken out by month. We hadn't, prior to last year, released this information publicly. So just to orient folks, because we'll see this chart again later on with the actual forecast embedded in it, we have here on the left-hand axis and a right-hand axis. The left-hand axis is the oil production rate in barrels of oil per day from 0 to 600,000. The orange curve that goes on the top that you see the high-frequency fluctuations for are daily production rates. What you see there overlaid with the purple, and you can't really see it in the forecast with the blue because early on in time we had a pretty good forecast overlaying the actuals, but you'll see a divergence there at the end, is the monthly forecast along with the average of the daily run tickets monthly to compare what we put forth in a forecast internally. Again, we have a monthly frequency, so we can see how those daily averages are turning into the monthly. If you take a look on the right-hand axis, you have cumulative production in millions of stock tank barrels. So that goes from 0 to 300 million barrels on the axis. That intercept on the far side where you see an orange straight line effectively overlaying a dashed blue line, those are the cumulative volumes. And so those go to the right-hand axis. The forecast last year was roughly 170 million barrels in total, and that's about where we got to. We were, again, slightly under on the forecast. Actuals came in slightly higher. But just wanted to kind of share the chart for reference, and this is what it looks like when you take a look at dailies as compared to our monthly forecast that we hold internally. And we'll, again, share actually an 18-month view later on to show the effect of the PICA development that we're planning to come online, that is planning to come online later this year.
Okay. Representative Hannon for Mr. Peltier.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Peltier, just to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly, because if I look at this, it looks like we start at zero, but that's just, you start at zero at the first day of the fiscal year, and the only point that really counts is the conclusion at the cumulative on the far right. So it's not that you were under-predicting that dramatically, the left axis telling us that, it's the cumulative difference.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, thank you for the question. Yes, the way I would take a look at this, and unfortunately, again, the cumulative forecast, the dashed blue line, you can't. It's very hard to see because the orange line overlays it. As you go through the year, there would be a gap. If the forecast is off, you'd see a gap between the straight orange line and the blue line that's underneath it. And that's the gap you would be worried about. If we're under-predicting in any single month, you'd start to see a divergence. And that's, I think, what you finally see there at the end of the chart in May of 2025 and June of 2025. You can see up above the daily actual production, the run tickets run slightly higher than the forecast. And so that's where you see the orange relatively straight line down below that represents the cumulative finally starts to outrun the cumulative forecast volume. But the difference here is so slight it's hard to tell. Yes.
Yes, follow up.
One follow up. And I was... Thank you, Co-Chair. And Mr. Peltier, in the previous slide, you used a range of a 0.3 percentage greater, and I think you said you like to have it within 5%, or was it 3%? And so doing the quick math, we're within that range of our cumulative forecast.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, yes. We are within the plus or minus 5% range we are targeting yearly.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Slide 8, I believe.
So again, we haven't gotten into more forecasts. This is a review of field performance and actuals for fiscal year of 2025. Just to kind of refresh folks, you know, the oil fields that we have on the North Slope and have been producing for decades, fields like the Prudhoe Bay unit, the Kuparuk River unit, and every year we expect these legacy fields to, you know, generally see a year-on-year decline. They're mature. The operators are reinvesting in them and getting the most out of them that they can from an economic perspective. But still, just the age of the fields themselves, the year-to-year decline is what we typically expect to see out of fields this large that have been producing for this long. However, in fiscal year 2025, as compared to fiscal year 2024, all of the North Slope production actually increased. So the whole basin on the North Slope went up roughly 7,000 barrels of oil per day, which is a great news story, and it does show the increase of investment and reinvestment on these legacy fields. What I have on the charts on the right, there are two of them. The top one is fiscal year annual average daily oil production for the entire North Slope going back to fiscal year 2019. So you broadly see a decrease back then from 495,000 barrels of oil per day, with some fluctuations due to the COVID pandemic going from 2020 into 2021, but broadly declining down to 2025, where you see the 468,000 roughly barrels of oil per day averaging for the past fiscal year. On the chart on the bottom, what we have is the breakdown just in change between fiscal year 2024 versus fiscal year 2025. So we can talk about which fields explicitly increased in production and those which decreased. I'll speak to the chart. The bullets are the same for the bottom chart, so I'm just going to speak to the chart, but the bullets on the left hand should correspond if you wanted to read the bullets as well. The decreases that we have in the fields are at the Colville River unit, the Greater Moose's Tooth unit, the Prudhoe Bay unit. We'll see those have all declined. That is mostly due to natural decline offset with development drilling when you lump those in. And then we have two other fields that have gone down as well. That's the Endicott unit and the North Star unit. There was no development drilling, no new wells drilled at either of those two units this past fiscal year. So what you see there in those volume losses, again, in terms of barrels of oil per day, is natural reservoir decline. One point I want to make about Prudhoe Bay, the unit itself makes over 200,000 barrels of oil per day. So having a decline rate less than 2% is pretty phenomenal for a field that large. This is the backbone of the volume that makes it into the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. So the operator there is doing a great job ensuring that reservoir decline is mitigated as best they can do it.
I'm struck by Kuparuk's performance, given that it's also a legacy field at this point. Is that fair, that they're going great guns there, apparently?
Right. So on the that's on the increases side, Chair Josephson. So if we go on the increases, last year we did see increases at the Kuparuk River unit. I'll skip to that one since you brought it up. And the operator there, ConocoPhillips, has done excellent base performance, and they've done a lot of new drilling. There have been some new projects that have gone on there. We had a project last year we brought through here. I believe it was called the Coyote Project or the KRU Nunatorok Project, depending on the version we had brought forth. I can't remember which one we shared. That project has come online with great success that affects the Kuparuk River unit. Along with that, they've had some additional positive well results out of the Schrader Bluff unit drilling their viscous oil as well. So the Kuparuk River unit has seen some nice positive benefits from the increased development drilling they've had at the field. Along with that, the Badami unit also increased for similar reasons. They had a brand new well, B133A. Prior to that, this one new well actually outproduced the rest of the field combined. So a very successful well for Badami. Milne Point has been a perennial increase in production rate, and that's been the infill drilling program that's been going on at Milne Point now for years. We continue to see that production growth due to infill drilling. Last year, the increase is over 4,000 barrels of oil per day. We hope to see more out of Milne Point. We'll see next year when we meet again if that production rate continues to increase, but I know the operator is doing what they can to maximize production out of the field there as well. And we have a specific slide about Milne Point in the future to talk about the activities that have gone on there. The Nikaichuk, Ugurik, and Point Thompson fields, along with Southern Maluvich. I'll hold Southern Maluvich for a minute. The Nikaichuk, Ugurik, and Point Thompson all saw production increases as well last year. For Point Thompson specifically, the large increase was because the prior fiscal year, the pipeline had been shut down for a number of months. It froze during a production upset in January, and it didn't unthaw again until the summer months when production was restored in fiscal year 2024. So fiscal year 2025 saw a nice production increase associated with that. And then a new positive story, the Southern Maluvich unit is a new field online. It was a project for us last year, and it's new to this chart. The production rate is relatively small, just given when it finally came on in the fiscal year. But we've seen a lot of positive things out of this, and next year we'll even be able to share a more positive story about that new field.
Mr. Peltier, the Point Thompson is known for gas and condensate. Is that right?
Yes.
But this is not condensate. This is oil.
It is condensate production, yes. We call it oil production, barrels of condensate per day, barrels of oil per day. The biggest difference when it comes to the liquid sales like that is there's a quality meter on your grade of oil. So Point Thompson will have its own different grading sold at its quality bank. but it's all lumped under oil production broadly, even if it is condensate.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Peltier, because the Point Thompson was a restoration, so the chart is accurate compared to the prior year because it lost a year, how does it compare to the preceding year before we had the pipeline error? Are we up from that, or are we?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that's a fantastic question. I'm going to answer it in twofold. One is I'm going to just get to the last bullet point on the slide. Detailed field charts are publicly available for view, so we can dig down to, like, anybody in the public can use the following link, and you can get down to the well level across any field on the North Slope using that. To answer your question specifically to Point Thompson, if you were going back to fiscal year 2023, you would see a large decrease in the – there's only one producer at the Point Thompson field, Point Thompson 17, and that well did decrease in production from fiscal year 23 into 24, not just because of the pipeline. There were some challenges with the well itself losing productivity, and so while it has increased, it hasn't gone back to where it had been. The current operator is actually remediating that and trying to refill the production facility, and we'll see how that activity goes this fiscal year. They're executing that work right now.
Thank you.
Okay, slide 9.
All right. Again, just for the record, this is Travis Peltier. We have a detailed slide here on slide 9 talking about the Milne Point unit and the history of this from the prior operator BP through the current operator Hillcorp. We wanted to highlight a few things on here, but again, just to orient everyone to the slide, this chart is slightly different. It comes from a different system. The left-hand oil axis is in oil and plus NGLs or natural gas liquids. That goes from 0 to 60,000 barrels of oil per day, represented by the letter K. That's a Microsoft thing. We couldn't change it, unfortunately, so we had to leave it with K. It's not typically an industry note. We usually use the letter M. So that's the oil production rates on the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side of this chart, we have water production rates. That goes from 0 to 200,000 barrels of water per day. What we have for oil production, the rate itself, you can see in green, just for easy reference on color. The water is represented by the blue dashed line, but there's no coloring underneath it. What we see here going back all the way to 1995, this is a calendar year now, not a fiscal year. These are monthly data points going to our latest data point, which was November of 2025. And the prior operator, BP, when the Milne Point was predominantly a Kuparuk light oil field, Kuparuk reservoir light oil field, the maximum production rate was in July 1998, just under 59,000 barrels of oil per day. And while BP was the operator, that production rate declined down to about 18,779 barrels of oil per day in November of 2014. At that point in time, BP had sold the asset to a company called Hillcorp. Hillcorp took it over operatorship in November and have ever since been working on stabilizing the field, which they did in the first few years of their operatorship, and then reinvesting into the Schrader Bluff sands, the more heavy oil, viscous oil that BP had not developed as much. And you've seen a year-on-year increase in production rate from that capital drilling program that's been ongoing since prior to 2018, but full-time since 2018. So along with that, Milne Point has invested new technologies in what is called polymer flooding, so something else BP, the prior operator, had not done. And both the new drilling along with the polymer flooding combined have seen field production rates now increase over 50,000 barrels a day in aggregate. So the last month we had data for was 50,906 barrels of oil per day. So I think it's a great success story showing that a new operator can come to the North Slope, bring new ideas, new thoughts, new technology, and execute well and do excellent things for even legacy assets such as Milne Point.
Yes, Director.
Chair, may I add something to there?
Of course.
Yeah, thank you. For the record, Derek Nottingham, and I just want to point out that I've been in the industry probably almost 30 years now. I have to go back and look. But it's very rare you see a revitalization of a field where you – almost duplicate the peak production of oil. You can see a mature field where there is a revitalization later down the road, but it never usually gets back to that previous peak. And the really outstanding thing that's happening here is the makeup of the oil is more of a viscous oil. It's from a reservoir called the Schrader Bluff, which basically it's a thicker, heavier oil than the Kuparik. So it's harder to move that around. The facilities originally weren't designed to handle that. So the operator has gone out and done a remarkable job in adjusting the operation, how they're drilling the wells, but also in the facilities to make them and adapt them to handle this amount of oil again.
Thank you. Yeah. And Hilcorp is known as a redeveloper and a someone who excels at this.
That is correct.
Okay. Slide 10.
Right. Through the chair, Travis Peltier. So we have here on this slide is a status update for some of the key North Slope projects. This is not all of them, but the ones we wanted to highlight today, just these five projects. I'm going to start off just in broad what the categories are. So we have the project names, Pikka Phase 1, Pikka Phase 2, and Willow are brand new projects for brand new fields. And then the last two projects, the Colville River Unit CD8 project, in the Prudhoe Bay unit, Project Taiga, are new pads within existing fields. So just to kind of share why there's a top and a bottom to this slide, there's a difference between brand new fields and the risk associated with that, along with putting a new pad in an existing field, generally lower risk, lower cost. So with that, let's talk about Pikka Phase 1. Last year, when we had the opportunity to meet, the operator, Santos, was doing construction and drilling activities. Project's first oil was anticipated in the second quarter of 2026, and now we are in 2026. And Pikka Phase 1 is more than 95% complete. Commissioning works are underway in advance of that first oil, and we actually now anticipate first oil in the end of the first quarter of 2026. The peak rate is estimated to be at 80,000 barrels of a day for this project. That won't be on day one. It's going to be a ramp-up to get to 80,000 barrels of oil per day. But Pikka Phase 1, we're expecting to make 80,000 barrels of oil per day.
With the hope for expansion in two other adjoining fields, I'm told?
Yeah, Chair Josephson, yes. Pikka Phase 2 is how we've kind of classified that. We actually have internally what we call a Pikka Phase 3 as well. That is a – last year when we came again, Pikka Phase 2 was in a conceptual engineering cost estimation stage. We had – seen public plans for that to move to what's called a FEED stage or a front-end engineering design stage in 2025, and then a financial investment or final investment decision in 2027. How that's kind of progressed over the past year, now that we're in January of 2026, Santos's focus is completing Phase 1. So rather than getting distracted by Phase 2, they want to get Phase 1 into first oil before proceeding on Phase 2 of the project. Phase 2 has traditionally had a new pad associated with it and a production expansion. And so we expect Phase 2 to have an additional 80,000 barrels of oil per day potentially added to Phase 1. So the total, if you add Pikka Phase 1 and Pikka Phase 2 together, you get 160,000 barrels of oil per day potential when both projects are online and at peak.
Fantastic. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Mr. Peltier, I have in the back of my mind that Santos sold or changed ownership. Am I incorrect, or they just kept the new owners but same name of operational company?
Sure.
Mr. Peltier.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I think it depends how far back you go. So if I go too far back, please forgive me. Once upon a time, I'll do the most recent iteration first. So Santos bought a company called Oil Search. They're both Australian companies. Oil Search has an Alaska subsidiary called Oil Search Alaska. They're a 51% owner of the Pikka field, both for Project Pikka Phase 1 and Pikka Phase 2, 51%. The other major owner is Repsol, who has a 49% share. If you go farther back than Oil Search having the 51% share, I believe Repsol had a higher working interest owner percentage at one point in time in history, upwards of 100%. But I'd forget the details, and I have to get back to you on that. But the current one is a 51-49 split between Santos, formerly known as Oil Search, but still with the in Alaska, the name Oil Search Alaska. Yeah.
Thank you.
And the names for the Pikka Phase 2 are, one is Horseshoe and the other is? We'll hear these names a lot in the coming years. Qualcomm or something?
Chair Josephson, referencing Horseshoe and Quokka, those are distinctly different projects from PICA. So I'll have a map later on showing where those are at. But they're wholly distinct units even within the North Slope, separate from PICA.
And separate from PICA Phase 2?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yes.
All right. So you were going to talk about Willow, I bet.
Yes. Yeah. So continuing on, the next major project we have is a ConocoPhillips project. Last year when we met, that project construction had started. First oil was anticipated in 2029. The end date, I know I'm going to kind of skip on. The first oil still remains on track in 2029, but the project is now more than 50% complete. The Willow Central facility is currently being constructed in Texas. Got taken out, it appears. Is planned for transit to the North Slope in 2027. So from where it's being constructed, we expect to see that Willow Central facility up here next calendar year at some point. So pretty exciting. The Willow project itself is expected to have a peak rate of 180,000 barrels of oil per day. One thing to distinguish this project is it is mostly located on federal. I think it's all located on federal lands. We'll have a map showing that in the future, whereas PICA Phase 1 and PICA Phase 2 are a mix of state and Alaska Native acreage. Moving on to the projects that are new pads within existing fields, we have the Colville River Unit CD8 pad. So this is a project that ConocoPhillips started permitting on and expected to permit early in 2025 with an environmental impact statement undertaken by the United States Army Corps of Engineers as the lead agency. So where we're at now in January of 2026 is the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has created a notice of intent as of September 9th of 2025, and stakeholder engagement is ongoing. There's a draft environmental impact statement comment period in effect now, and it lasts until the fall of 2026. Shortly after that, a record of decision for the project is planned for early 2027. The project is expected to come online for first oil in 2030. So still a ways out, but work underway. For this one, we didn't have a public estimate, so we are sharing our internal estimate for a mid-case for the CD8 project. So the DNR rate estimate for this is about 20,000 barrels of oil per day in the mid-case.
Okay. Sorry, Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Through the chair. So all these projects here, 80,000, 160,000, 180,000, that kind of takes me back to slide 4 where the North Slope forecast, the high was about, just off the chart here, I'm looking at about 975,000, if I just kind of guesstimate, for the high forecast. And it's all due to these projects we just talked about. Is there anything that's going to derail those projects? Do we see? We're being optimistic. Obviously, we want to be optimistic. But is there anything that's going to derail those projects? Or do we kind of anticipate that our high estimate on that forecast page is going to be pretty close to being what we're going to see?
Mr. Peltier.
Yeah.
Or through director.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. The way I'd kind of look at slide 4, yes, there's a high forecast and a low forecast. When we put these together, the official forecast is what we use for these, not these estimates, but these numbers represent our mid-case ranges that we have in there. So what I'd call the official forecast, when they sum up in getting just under 700,000 barrels of oil per day, I think is a more representative case of where they could be. I'd kind of mentioned plus or minus 5% per year on an uncertainty for the next year on the forecast. Each year that uncertainty grows, so we're never sure if a project will be successful or not, but we hope in bulk all the projects yield a success case. And we'll look at those later on in the slide deck. I don't recall the slide number, but we do have a forecast to show just that. But again, with the uncertainty, the high case and low case, there's a chance that some projects don't come online and you don't see these large volumes, and that's what the low case is meant to represent, is kind of what the low range could be. And it's the same for the high case. If the volumes are significantly better than anticipated, you know, I'd say the probability is not as high as the official case, right? That's where we're going. But there's a chance they could be significantly better than we had originally planned as well. That's not unheard of. And so those what the high and the low cases are meant to represent is just that band of uncertainty. And that's why it increases through time.
Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Mr. Peltier or Mr. Nottingham. So just want to take a kind of a bird's eye view at this, taking a step back. We have in front of us a chart that talks about basically an additional 400,000 barrels a day in production. And just putting that in context, you guys have been at this a long time. Like, when's the last time you've been able to sit in front of a legislative body like this and talk about these projects? And there's probably half a dozen projects that aren't even on this list that are kind of floating around there. Sockeye 2, you mentioned. At these levels of new production and really our state's history, through the chair.
Either gentleman, Mr. Nottingham, Director Nottingham.
Chair Josephson, for the record, I'm Derek Nottingham. You know, I've been at this in this role for 4 years, and we've been talking about these projects all that time. But you know, we've seen them go through various stages and lots of challenges over that time. The thing that's different about this year is there are literally boots on the ground. There are facilities being installed. There's lots of money being spent. Like, the PICA is at a point where there's no going back. There's going to be production coming online. Willow is very much into the project. So these things are becoming reality rather than concept at this point. I hope that kind of gets to your question, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, follow up, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair, through the chair. Yeah, no, the reason I bring it up is because, I mean, this is kind of like an historic moment in the state's recent history, right? We've talked a lot about declining production. I'm 38 years old, right? So this would be the first time in my lifetime that Alaska is actually going to see an increase, like a substantial increase in production. I'm not talking about 2,000 BPD a day or something like that, but this will be a substantial increase in production. And I think we should all kind of take the time to recognize that that moment came with a lot of grit and a lot of challenge, massive capital investment through industry, and a lot of time. You know, I'm old enough to remember when we talked about our last tax structure that we were going to have fruits of our labor and production, and you know, they might have been wrong on the time frame, but here we are, you know, over a decade past the road, kind of seeing those things come to fruition. So with that being said, I do have a question regarding other projects that have been out there, I'm sure you'll talk about in the future, that did not make the list. So Sockeye 2, for example, and some of the other minor kind of projects. So I'm curious, what determines whether or not you put a status update on a list on this slide, and what determines that you don't, through the chair?
Mr. Peltier.
Yeah. For the record, Travis Peltier, through the chair, Representative Stapp, to answer your question, what projects make it on this list and which ones do not. So this specific list, I wanted to put the large projects that are either right around the corner or extremely material to the future production forecast. So that's what made it on this top five list. You could call it a top six if you include iPad and OPAD separately. Later on, we'll have a map showing all the projects that were included in the production forecast for the North Slope. And then there's one project for the Cook Inlet as well that we have in here in the aggregate forecast as well. Those projects we do discuss every year. The criteria for that, if you're interested in the details, is really around, do we have a development plan? Is this a known resource? Does the operator actually have an intent to develop this within the next 10 years? There's a lot of discussions around what does and does not get included. So if you're also talking about years past, some projects that have had challenges that we've dropped from the project list, you might remember something like Liberty as a for instance. We didn't think that one would come online in the next 10 years, so it's no longer a project we're including. So there are projects that have been on and projects that have fallen off, and we have that's the criteria. It's basically it though, is will it be on in the next 10 years? Is there a development plan? Has there been a known resource actually found to support that?
And a last quick follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Sure, follow-up. Yeah, Representative Stapp.
Co-Chair, through the chair. So I'm glad you mentioned Liberty, because I'm always kind of curious. When we talk about these projects, we don't think about all the times that, and it's not been that often, but we have companies that are spending billions of dollars of their own at-risk capital to kind of develop these projects, and sometimes they don't work out. I know that one of the other representatives mentioned that. I mean, how often does that happen? How often does a private company go out and spend tons of money in Alaska and then you know, they go for broke and then they don't come up with anything, and now they're on the hook for all that expense through the chair.
Well, through the chair, Representative Stapp, I'll share a story about, I guess, two different projects for an operator that no longer works up here. But if you go all the way back to Prudhoe Bay, Prudhoe Bay is an amazing story, right? It's a field that when it was originally developed only expected to make 9.6 billion barrels of oil. It's significantly over that now, billions of barrels over that. But then you have other projects that haven't worked out in the past, per the operator's original expectations. Again, picking on BP, since they're no longer here, is the Badami field. If you take a look at their expectation for that field, it was supposed to come online and peak, I think it was around 35,000 barrels of oil per day. And it came nowhere near that. I think the fourth day of production was peak rate, if you had the daily data. And it was just under, I think, it was under 20,000, but I think it was 11,000 total. The monthly production rate averages significantly less than that. And it declined down to about 1,000 barrels of oil per day. Again, I'm rounding here, roughly, for most of its production history, until the B-133A well was recently drilled. So I'd say that one didn't work out in total.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm thinking of Shell's efforts in the Beaufort Sea. Of course, it's notorious. And there was a, I think Kalis wanted to develop Smith Bay. Is that right? And that didn't happen. Although Ugarit is near there, maybe? I don't know.
Chair Joseph, and I can speak to that. For the record, Derek Nottingham. Yeah, Shell did make efforts. I can't remember the exact year, but to explore in the Beaufort Sea, that turned out to be very expensive and very hard to plan for. It cost them a lot of money, and they essentially abandoned those efforts. So the recognition that Alaska has a lot of resources there, there are extreme challenges some places, you know, where the location is so remote that the equipment to do those kind of operations is so specialized that it gets really expensive, and things have to go almost perfect to find the oil, appraise it, and develop it. So it does present a lot of challenge. Smith Bay is another area where a lot of resource has been found, like you mentioned, by Kalis back, I can't remember those exact years either, but it is in a remote location. It's state land. It's out in state waters, but access to it is through the NPRA. So the previous federal administration presented a lot of challenges for operators, explorers to go out and explore even state lands because the access generally had to be through the NPRA. So those kind of things are history of development of resources are kind of laced with some of those really logistical challenges, some of the federal challenges and those kind of things.
So. Representative Moore, question.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Josephson. Through the chair, can we get an update on the PICA road access with it being on federal lands and having the state and NPR boundaries and such? In the summer, I know there were some issues, and then in the winter, we used the ice roads to get there, and that doesn't seem to have a lot of jurisdiction issues, but where are we at with update on that?
Through the chair, Representative Moore, the PICA road access issues are pretty much resolved in that Conoco and Santos have come to a use agreement, a mutually agreed to use agreement. There was legal action that was taken. It was actually ruled, I believe, I'm not a lawyer, so I'll kind of try to step through this as best I can, but there was a ruling, I think, in Superior Court against the state's position on that, and in our efforts to bring that to the Supreme Court, during that time, I believe the two companies mutually resolved that issue with a commercial agreement, And therefore, I believe the Supreme Court ruled it a moot point and vacated the Superior Court's ruling on that. But we can get our Department of Law to kind of follow up on the specific details, but I believe that's where that is.
Follow up, Representative Moore?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the update. And so there's no projected delays for PICA going online because of the road access then?
Through the chair, Representative Moore, that's correct.
Great, thank you.
Let's go to slide 11.
For the record, this is Travis Peltier. Do you mind, Chair Josephson, could I just finish the last project on this slide? Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, slide 10.
So on slide 10, the very last project, I'll just address this very briefly, is a brand new project in the Prudhoe Bay unit. This was not included in the project's list last year. We didn't present it to this group last year. And this is a project, again, that Hillcorp is proposing to move forward on. It's two new pads in the Prudhoe Bay unit. You might see it referred to in the news as Omega Pad and iPad. You might hear it referred to as Project Taiga. It all refers to the same two pads being developed on the west side of Prudhoe Bay. The first pad is expected to come online with first oil in 2028, and the second pad is expected to come online sometime between 2028 and 2030, depending on when the final investment decision is made.
Okay.
Or sorry, FID will be in 2028 to 2030 with first of all, 2 years after final investment decision. Sorry for that misspeaking. Peak rate for both of those pads when online could be as high as 40,000 barrels of oil per day.
Okay. Slide 11.
Yep. Moving on to slide 11 in the Cook Inlet Basin. So we're just, again, showing highlights from the basin itself from fiscal year 2024 into fiscal year 2025. Cook Inlet Basin declined roughly 8%. So again, the Cook Inlet Basin is actually the most mature basin in all of Alaska's assets. This has been on since the late 1950s for all the oil fields. A lot of the oil fields that are down there have been online for over seven decades, so quite a long time. So again, you're expecting to see year-on-year production decline. 8% for Cook Inlet, where it's currently at now, is about 692 barrels of oil per day production drop. And just to kind of highlight, the Cook Inlet Basin oil supply it supplies in-state refineries. And so it's pretty critical that we continue to maximize this resource as best we can. Hillcorp operates a lot of the fields down in the Cook Inlet. Their priority is natural gas development out of necessity for, you know, continuing to ensure homes are heated, power is generated for the South Central region. Mm-hmm. So if we take a look at, I know I'm being cognizant of the time, I'm just going to jump down to the production chart where we have production changes.
Mm-hmm, please.
And just in bulk, I'll say that again, there's not a lot of new wells being drilled at the existing fields down in the Cook Inlet. That's why they all have production drops. All are experiencing natural decline. There is well work that Hillcorp does at all the fields. Sometimes, like what you see with Readout Shoal, the well work that is done actually overcomes the decline rate that you'd have for the year. So that's why the Readout Shoal number is positive, was the well work that was done there over the year. It's not a new well, it's just it ended up being a net positive number. Everything else, you know, they're working on doing what they can to manage the field decline, but it's still a net negative.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Chair Josephson, through the chair. You had indicated that you said the primary focus in this area is gas production. Do you anticipate that if a gas line were to happen, that there may be a shift in this region to focus on oil a little bit more? Or is it just unknown?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Bynum, I think that's a great question. And I'll be honest, I don't know the answer to that. My assumption is that the operators will do what they can to maximize the value of their existing fields, regardless of if there's a natural gas pipeline down here or not.
Thank you.
Slide 12.
So now we're going to transition into the production forecasting approach, the methodology that we use to build a forecast. Just to kind of highlight the stability that we've had here, there have been no changes in methods used from the fall of 2022 and spring of 2023 forecasts until now. I do think last year I brought up that we had a math error that we found, and we've continued to keep that analytical error out of the forecast.
Okay. I've been losing sleep about that.
Yeah.
Representative Galvin.
Why, thank you. Through the chair, this is a question that's related to forecast but unrelated to what you have on paper here. we know there was an audit done at some point that talked about whether or not we were negotiating if the oil companies had written off the appropriate amount of write-offs and then were giving the state the appropriate amount due to the state. And I just don't know where that is right now and if it's appropriate if you could give us a heads up on that, just because at one point we were hearing from various sources that it could be, you know, we went from hundreds of millions to kind of to zero in terms of our negotiating, ensuring that the state was getting its full due amount based on negotiations around its write-offs. So I thought I would ask you about that.
I know that a sister agency is pretty involved in that as well, but yeah. You have a comment.
Yeah, if you have anything, because it helps us to know whether or not we can expect any funds toward that end.
Yeah, for the record, I can't speak to that. Okay. Representative Gallum, apologies.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. All right, for the record.
Please.
For the record, Travis Peltier. So again, just to kind of go over how do we build this production forecast year on year, taking a look at the top bullet point, the bulk of the production forecast is done using what we call decline curve analysis, and it's for all of the producing pools on the North Slope and the Cook Inlet. We treat all the individual pools on the North Slope separately, and then we actually have the Cook Inlet rolled up as a single pool. That is what you get to see reflected in the Department of Revenue Sources book. There were roughly 41 pools along the Alaska North Slope and then the Cook Inlet producing as of June 30th, 2025. And so those all represent the entirety of what we do for production decline and the decline curves. Along with that, we actually work with, through the Department of Revenue, in person and in writing interviews with all of the operators, both on the North Slope and the Cook Inlet. And in those conversations, and along with reviewing our plans of development that we have in-house already, we determined there were 13 projects worthy of considering under development and under evaluation that we reviewed. These projects use confidential information from the operators, so we don't typically report on them individually unless the information we know is already public, like we had on a prior slide. And the production from these projects is risked and adjusted for scope, chance of occurrence, and start date. So scope of contribution represents the oil production rate. So how much oil production is it going to contribute? 12 of these projects are located on the Alaska North Slope. One is in the Cook Inlet, and I'll have a map of the Alaska North Slope here on a future slide. Okay. Moving on to slide 14, we also break the production forecast out into various categories of production. So that's for ongoing and future production. We have, for the current production, what we call CP. So you'll see this acronym repeated in future slides. This is the ongoing production from the existing fields. So those 41 pools that we talked about on the prior slide. We do take into account well and facility uptime in our forecasts for these forecasts, the operator spending to maintain that base production, and any sort of changes in reservoir management as well. We'll reflect that in our forecast as best we can. Along with that, we do get a sense for future projects under development and under evaluation. And what we mean by that is any production that requires new investment. So that's drilling new wells or, you know, putting in new production facilities, new projects. The rate contribution, there is uncertainty in future well performance. So when you drill a well in a legacy field, it's not going to produce the same as it did 20 years ago. So getting a sense of how new wells contribute versus prior wells. Along with that, we have to take a look at scope. So, you know, how many new wells are coming in, how much facility capacity is being installed. Those all go into our evaluations in the under-development category, along with the under-evaluation category. The under-evaluation category also has timing risks associated with that, so uncertainty in timing. In prior presentations, you know, we've had stuff like PICA Phase 1 has actually had a timing risk associated with it. And in this one, since it's so near, that project timing uncertainty has shrunk significantly. But all of our other projects like Willow, the ones we've talked about before, PICA Phase 2, we keep that uncertainty in timing, and that is all represented through all of our forecasts as well. And then there are commercial risks that also get taken into account. So oil price, for instance, if you have a break-even oil price, you know, does it make economic sense for this project to come on if oil price is, you know, high or low? So those are also taken into account for our production forecasts.
Okay. Question from Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Chair Josephson, through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Peltier. There's a lot of questions that get sent to us talking a little bit about global volatility in oil markets, and we know that volatility specifically in the Northern Hemisphere do directly impact oil prices. I do understand that Alaska's oil market is very different than maybe the Gulf oil market, but do we anticipate that there would be any climate condition that would impact production in Alaska where we would curtail production at all because of that global volatility?
Can I ask a follow-up before answering?
Sure.
Can you explain what you mean by climate condition, please?
Well, I'm talking about volatility in the oil markets. So specifically, there's a lot of discussion in the news about Venezuelan oil or what might be happening in the Middle East. Those production volatilities obviously impact prices, but is there a condition that would potentially impact our production here in Alaska?
Mr. Peltier.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Bynum. For the record, this is Travis Peltier. I don't necessarily see the volume of oil being affected from legacy fields with things like Venezuela being diverted necessarily to the United States refineries along the lower 48. And the same thing with the Middle Eastern supply. In the near term, I don't see that affecting, again, legacy field production. If you do have large price decreases, you might recall back in 2014, oil prices were near $100 a barrel. And starting around then, Middle Eastern fields ramped up production in a fight for market share, and oil prices dropped pretty precipitously from 2014 into 2016. And so projects, you'd start seeing those get deferred. So that absolutely affects future production for the state of Alaska, but not a near-term effect. And if we go back to a near-term effect, if you take a look at the COVID pricing, in April of 2020, the spot price for WTI, I can't remember the exact number, but got down something like negative $40 a barrel, yet the legacy fields in Alaska continue to produce. So that's I think, an important note, that you can have a pretty wild swing in oil production price, or sorry, oil price, but the fields are still going to produce oil. The companies still need to make money, and with the exception of negative pricing, typically they try to maximize volume.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yes, Representative Schrage.
Thank you. I guess in a similar color, I'm curious if there the need for capital to make investments in other markets. I know there's a lot of pressure to ramp up production in Venezuela. Would the need for capital to make those investments have any potential impact on the development in Alaska and our ability to bring some of these projected barrels online?
Co-Chair Schrage, thanks for that question. It's a great question, and that's one we are continually asking our operators as well through our confidential discussions with them. The short answer is I can't tell you today if there are any effects with that right now. In broad brush, the state of Alaska is staying competitive. It's obviously very important for us, right? Having a large resource base and a competitive place to do business is very important. But in terms of, is capital currently being diverted from Alaska projects to the lower 48 or to overseas locations, I have nothing I can share with you today on follow-up.
Yes, follow-up. Co-Chair Schrage.
Thank you. So conceivable, not necessarily in your forecast, but conceivable that capital needs elsewhere could impact us here. Are there how much exposure is there? How many companies that are in our forecast are also contemplating, to your knowledge, investment in Venezuela or others? I know, I believe I read that Hilcorp was potentially pursuing investment in Venezuela, but are there others that I should be aware of?
Mr. Peltier.
Co-Chair Schrage. So I don't have a number for you today. I mean, I read the news, and I saw the names of the companies that had CEOs represented at the White House, with which I could tell you there was at least three companies that work in the state of Alaska, whether operator or non-operated, that were at that meeting. And only one of them said that they weren't interested in Venezuela at the time, or they'd have to think seriously about it, I should say. The other two companies were more optimistic than that, but I can't tell you if they're already diverting capital or not. That's beyond what we look for in this forecast.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Stapp.
Yep. Thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the chair to Mr. Director Nottingham or Mr. Peltier, whoever can better field the question. So curious on this Venezuela question. I mean, if we're worried about capital flight from Alaska projects, wouldn't the best way to guarantee that we would have that would be to do big tax increases on companies while they're looking at moving capital other places, through the chair?
Chair Josephson, through the chair, Representative Stapp, it's a very interesting question. I don't know that I have the answer today for you.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah.
Yes, follow up, Representative Stapp.
Because, you know, I'm curious. I mean, if we're worried about other places in the country having competitive projects, you would think that we probably wouldn't want to talk about making doing business in Alaska a lot more expensive for them. Just a thought, through the chair.
Okay, are we ready for slide 15? I know I am.
Through the chair, for the record, Travis Peltier, slide 15. Okay. All right, here we are, the major projects under evaluation in the under evaluation category that are considered for the fall 2025 forecast on the North Slope of Alaska. I'll speak to the map, but basically these projects were by definition not online by June of 2025. I know PICA is planning to come online, but since it was not yet online by June of 2025, it's still considered a project. These have a higher risk factor than the currently producing fields, but they are all known discoveries with identifiable operators, and they require major investments. So those are the general characteristics of what we put in for major projects on the slope. That list, if we go from west to east on the map, you can see the Willow development in red. That's all on federal land and a federal unit in green. Moving over, this is, I think, what we talked about, the Horseshoe unit. The Horseshoe project is just south of that with a mix of state and federal acreage. The Colville River unit CD8 project is, you'll see the southern part of the Colville River unit. There's a green triangle representing where that is at. You have the PICA unit, again, just to the east of that. PICA phase 2 and 3 and the PICA unit development are along a north slope or north-south line. In the hashed unit that says non-producing state lease. And as we continue to go west, we've got the Quokka Mitkuk, just the unit right, just to the west, of, or sorry, to the east of PICA. And then the Prudhoe Bay Omega Pad, we're going to skip the Kuparuk River unit. We don't have any major projects in development for them right now. They're executing the Coyote project and the Kariu-Nunatoa project still, but those moved into currently producing pools. So the Prudhoe Bay unit has the Omega Pad, iPad projects on the map listed there. And then we go south of the Prudhoe Bay unit to the Pantheon Great Bear projects for Theta West, Talitha, and Alcade. And that is it for the projects that we carried for this one. We don't have anything east of Prudhoe Bay carried as a major project for this forecast period.
Okay.
So let's move on to the slide 17, the fall 2025 North Slope annualized forecast. We already discussed this chart earlier on. I believe it was slide 4. So I'm just going to cut to the bullet points because I know we have limited time left. And the DNR forecast in the short term for fiscal year 2026, the annualized average daily statewide production is 464,500 barrels of oil per day, with which North Slope production is 457,000 barrels of oil per day. The range on that from the low to the high case is 418,400 barrels of oil per day, and a high case is 495,300 barrels of oil per day. The new operator lines, so this is distinct from the one that we had seen showing the actuals versus operators. This is the one that we rolled up for this fiscal year. The operator line for this one is 476,000 barrels of oil per day. In the long term, we see the forecast. So the operator's long-term forecast, again, does not include new fields, right? So this is, again, existing production out of the existing fields that are already online. And that does fall within our high to low range. It does diverge at the end of the forecast period because we don't have those new projects in there. So I just wanted to reiterate that again. And the differences that we have between the low case, the official case, and the high case is due to the uncertainty analysis in all of our projects. And again, our uncertainty band increases with time. There are just things in the future you don't know when they're going to come on from a timing risk, if they're going to be successful, what rates new fields will actually produce at. And then the other item of note is the production forecast assumes operator plans are static, right? At some point in time, we just have to stop making assumptions. And so this assumes all those plans and project drivers remain unchanged. We'll do, of course, an update for this body in the spring in a few months. I believe that'll come out in mid-March sometime. And we'll give an update on how those assumptions have changed as well.
Slide 18. Oh, sorry, Representative Tomaszewski for Mr. Peltier.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Peltier. So I'm looking at this slide, and it looks like between 26, 27 is pick a one. I'm just assuming since that's coming on in March, imagine the end of the year we're going to have approximately 80,000. And 29 through 31, I'm assuming that's Willow, that large increase of 180, 160. But then from 31 to 35, that's about 100,000. That's the other pick a two. But you referenced pick a three on a previous slide. Is there an estimate on pick a three on how many barrels per day that could be happening there?
Yeah. Mr. Peltier?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. So pick a phase three to answer that question specifically. We don't view that as an enhanced production capacity out of the facility. We view it as a new pad filling ullage that will open up as pick a phases one and two decline through time. So it'll be a new pad with wells that get drilled and basically fill the space that opens up. So a continuation of the peak rate of the pick a facility and the pick a unit overall.
Okay, thank you.
So the next slide on slide 18, again, for the record, this is Travis Peltier. We wanted to show this year, last year we showed a 12-month future forecast with all the questions around PICA and when that rate will be seen. We're actually showing an 18-month snapshot, so slightly farther on a month-by-month basis from the previous chart. What we also have here is the actuals through January 14th, 2026, because we had them. We can compare how does our forecast look, you know, versus where we're actually at now, that since the forecast pencils down was late November, how are we doing? And we can see right now that the actual production forecast for the North Slope is running slightly higher, but generally on trend with our actuals. You don't see much of a divergence if we skip to the cumulative production line, the bottom one that goes, starts at zero, and since this is now an 18-month forecast, goes over 260 million barrels a day on the right. There's not much of a divergence between the forecasted cumulative volume and the actual cumulative volume. What we wanted to highlight with this, though, is we know PICA Phase 1 is anticipating to come on at the end of the first quarter. We don't think it's going to come on at, again, that 80,000 barrels a day of production rate. So you'll see a nominal increase there in April of 2026, and that looks like it declines through the summer. The big reason for that is the legacy fields in the North Slope are seasonally constrained. A lot of them produce a lot of gas, and as it heats up on the North Slope, their ability to produce oil goes down. The other thing is, for that reason, they actually do turnaround activity or summer maintenance for all of the facilities on the North Slope, and there are some large turnaround activities expected to happen in the June, July, and August timeframe. And so as we expect PICA to ramp up, we're expecting these facilities to actually slow down. And so what you finally see is this large production increase in August of 2026. And that's the cumulative response of PICA Phase 1 ramp up, along with those facilities ending their summer turnaround cycles. Okay. And then production increase from there as you enter colder months in the winter.
Got it. Thank you. Slide 19.
All right, this is where we're going to break out the Alaska statewide annualized forecast versus their forecast production categories. There are two charts. Again, the annual average daily oil production, 0 to 700,000 barrels a day, is on both charts just to show the relative contribution of the existing base production with new projects and new drilling. What we have here on the chart on the left also has an overlay of the spring of 2025 production forecast, so you can see how things have changed from the most recent update to this one. And what we typically see, or what we have seen, is there's been a lot of stability. The spring of 2025 forecast, I think by the numbers, was actually a little higher than what we have. I'd have to go look and see what it was. But slightly higher for fiscal year 2026. This is a small reduction from what we put out last fall for fiscal year 2026 and last spring as well. But you see that those existing fields decline. Earlier, I believe there was a question about, you know, seeing roughly 400,000 barrels of oil per day of production increase from new projects. How do we see that kind of come forth? And you see these legacy fields decline on the blue chart, and we do expect that to continue through time. So as you bring new fields on, a lot of it is actually just replacing oil that's being lost through production decline. The orange curve represents new drilling, so that's just the next 12 months of new drilling in existing fields. And while it might be the smallest of the curves, it does show a material impact on the production forecast and the continued value of that drilling as we go point forward. The rest of the drilling in months 13 through 120 of the forecast are contained in the gray. And so if I go over to the chart on the right then, the under evaluation, these are the future projects now, just overlaid against each other. So you do see the spring forecast versus this forecast. Again, we have slight differences. I didn't necessarily correct the spring forecast with the Torok projects and the ConocoPhillips projects that were being executed at the time. I wanted to leave them on there just to show the relative contribution that projects like Pikka coming on will have in the near term, which is to say that it's going to be quite a large project that we're going to see here coming on. You do see there's a gap that develops kind of in the 2028, 2029, 2030 time frame, and that has to do with the uncertainty of some projects that we've talked about, like Pikka Phase 2. We weren't sure when they were going to come on relative to our expectations last year, so the uncertainty opened up on that, and that's why you see a production change from last year's expectations versus this year's.
All right.
All right.
Representative Bynum?
Just a really quick follow-up.
Quickly for Mr. Peltier.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Really quick, all these projections just take into consideration current known information. Does it take into are you guys looking at all at potential of favorable administration, opening of NPRA, challenges to Willow, two-pad, three-pad, so that kind of thing? Are those in any consideration, and if so, is that something you'd bring back at a later time?
Mr. Peltier.
Yep. Through the chair, Representative Bynum, it's a great question and something we actually debate internally a fair amount. What I would say for this specific forecast is we did not take into account any actions of a new federal administration with respect to Willow. You know, we know there's new exploration going on in the Willow and the Greater Moose's Tooth area that's been publicly released. And a lot of these exploration wells, we're not sure because there's no found oil, there's no defined project yet, how that's going to play in the production forecast. So while we are excited to see the activity and we want to know how it's going to play out into a production forecast, we have not included any barrels associated with that exploration activity.
Thank you. Yeah. All right, let's wrap up with page 20 and give us a summary of that.
I'll try to wrap this up as quick as possible for you. I know you have to leave. So the production forecast continues to use the best information we can gather from both the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Revenue. We try to make this as accurate as we can, both near and long term. It is a static view on production. Again, you know, as assumptions change, you know, from business, or I should say as business plans change, our assumptions become outdated. We update them as best we can. The DNR's fall 2025 outlook does show mean annual production starting at approximately 465,000 barrels per day, increasing to 685,000 barrels of oil per day at the end of the outlook period. And I think for that, I'm just going to skip on because I know you guys are short for time and skip to the final slide, which is to say thank you on behalf of the Division of Oil and Gas and the fall 2025 production forecasting team. It's always an honor to come here and share the work. So on behalf of the entire team, we just wanted to say thank you.
Mr. Peltier, thank you for your good work. And Director Nottingham, we appreciate your being here as well. We saw some good news there, certainly maybe not for this legislature, but for future legislatures in the relatively near term. Anything else either gentleman would like to add? Okay. I'd like to thank our guests from Division of Oil and Gas for their presentation. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, the 22nd of January at 1:30. At that meeting, we will hear the Department of Revenue present its 2025 fall revenue forecast. With that, we're going to adjourn this meeting at 2:56. Thank you again.
Thank you.